Welcome to another episode of the Data Revolution podcast. My guest today is Brandon Rohrer, who I found online and cyber stalked. Welcome, Brandon.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
I really wanted to have a chat with you because, I actually found you by I was Googling ML back in the day, a couple of years ago, and I found your e2eml.school website, and it talked about your learning journey about machine learning, and I was really fascinated by it and showed it to my team, who found it an excellent resource. So I found you there and I started cyber stalking you, and I think I started following you on Twitter when it was still a thing, and now we're contacts on Mastodon. So that's how I found you, and I'm really pleased that we get to have this chat.
I love that story. To me, that highlights the very highest promise of social media. Because I've never been to Australia. I live in Boston, and the chances that we would have bumped into each other in a coffee shop are probably not high. So.
Yeah, and that's one of the things, and it's one of the things I think is really so tragic about the demise of Twitter is how everything's fragmented now.
Yes, I'm so sad. I enjoyed Twitter a lot. I had connections with the data science, machine learning communities that honestly are gone now. Like there's a handful on Mastodon and there's LinkedIn, but there the tone is different. It's like all you got to make sure it's suitable for work and kind of pretty on the up and up. And then just informal channels outside of that, but Twitter was I'm still mourning that as well. Still looking for like the next incarnation of what that could be.
And the real problem for me is people are fragmented. So some people have gone to Mastodon, like the entire InfoSec community, holus bolus, moved to Mastodon in November 2022, because I had a Mastodon account from 2017, but there was no one there. Suddenly, in November 2022, my entire cyber community was there. And I was like, oh, well, I've got a reason to move now. And then a bunch went to Blue Sky. And then LinkedIn's the surprising winner, which is really weird with people kind of using it like Twitter. But anyway, it's just a strange world now. So how did you come to be working with data? Because I loved your website, and it was like it talked through your journey about learning ML, which was really fascinating.
It was not my original destination. My first technical love is robots and robotics. And so that's what I did my graduate work in. My degrees are in mechanical engineering. My dissertation is in using a robot to rehabilitate people who have had a stroke. But in the process of doing that, this was back in 2000, I had a whole bunch of human movement data, someone moving a joystick around for an hour, 3 times a week, times 6 weeks, times 50 people. And back then that was gigabytes of data. Like that was
Oh,
like a
so much.
considerable amount. Yeah. And I had to find patterns in this. And I had a rough idea what I was looking for, but I wasn't certain. So I had to hack together a database. I had to hack together some routines. I was working in MATLAB, and it was like, anyway, so it was like I was doing algorithmic stuff and data stuff without any training that was formal to it. And but this ended up tapping into my love because it, through the course of the research, revealed some telling things about how humans moved, which led to some interesting hypotheses about how we could help robots move in a way that was more robust, more able to work in an unpredictable environment, which led me to say, great, well, maybe I can start making some robot learning algorithms and control algorithms that are based on this. And then pretty soon I'm doing things that look a lot like existing machine learning techniques. And someone stands up in a talk and says, hey, isn't this just, insert
And
algorithm
you
name.
suddenly go, huh?
And then I was like, oh shoot, I should learn about all that stuff so I don't look dumb. And so I got a bunch of machine learning textbooks and just started kind of reading through them. I mean, this is over years. There's no Rocky montage here, but and I realized also that a lot of this stuff, I'd had this experience over and over again where I'd read through a handful of papers and posts and book chapters. And when the realization finally clicked for how it worked, I was like, oh, well, that was less complicated than I thought. And I realized, like, well, what if I wrote the thing that I wish I had when I first started learning this? And so I started doing that for one of my early ones was for convolutional neural networks when I was back at Microsoft. Turned it into a video and it got a bunch of views. And it's still one of my most popular ones where someone's like, the comments a lot of times will be like, I got it. Like, I've seen a half dozen other tutorials, but I got it. And it's full of errors and oversimplifications, but I am proud of it because it took some important, some hard to grasp concepts and just cartoonized them and made them easy to ingest. And it's not really out of any deep altruism that I've done this, but I find it very satisfying for me. And if you read between the lines, whenever I publish something new, you can always tell that that's what I'm confused about in a particular month. I'm trying to figure it out, and so I write it up. And then it's just kind of like over years, kind of congealed into this big collection of posts and videos and whatnot.
Oh, yeah, it's a really great resource. I showed it to my team because we were grappling with, we did our first machine learning proof of concept back in 2019, and we were trying to predict which students would fail a course during the course.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because it's highly correlated. Students failing courses means they fail degrees, and it's highly correlated to them self-harming. So we actually wanted to find out who might be on a trajectory towards self-harm.
Got it. So
And
the course failure was like the leading indicator for the thing that you were really concerned about that was more rare.
yeah, and the thing was, we had data on who was in the counseling service and was getting treatment, but all the people who weren't were the ones who would go on to self-harm. So it was kind of a really big problem that we wanted to solve. So, and it was our first foray into it, and we were on the Microsoft platform, and they were really helpful to us, and we did a great proof of concept. And it took 6 weeks to build this model. It's still running in production now.
Oh, wow.
And it just won an award, which is great, a Gartner award.
that is such a good story because it's rare that someone actually uses machine learning to make the world a better place. But it
Yeah.
sounds like that's actually the case here. I'm curious, did you have to stretch to like figure out what was important to measure or to include in the model.
It
Like
was
that's like
hilarious. Yeah.
arms work.
So the teachers had five factors that they thought were important, and we tested all sorts of factors because we had all the data, and it turned out to be the five factors that the teachers thought were important.
Okay.
So they were right. So they were very chuffed that they were right. But
Oh,
it
okay.
was really basic things. Has the student logged onto the learning management system? Have they done their first assignment? All of those sorts of things that you would think are really predictive are. And it's been running at 95%+ accuracy since then. So it's pretty good. But that was our first foray. And I had my development team were like, "What?" And I found your website and showed it to them, and they were like, "Oh my God, this is so helpful."
I'm so glad. It's funny because a lot of times, like, I mean, I did a deep dive into transformers because I wanted to understand about transformers and LLMs and all of that. And at the very end, in my own mind, the punchline after doing these deep dives usually comes down to, you know what, it really comes down to how good the data is going in. And you can
Oh.
have these huge models and dump in all of these unrelated features, and the results are meh. But if you have even a very simple model and you have domain experts like the teachers saying, like, you know what, my gut says it's this handful of things, let's look at it, that wins every time.
Well, the interesting thing is, every organization needs to get better at data governance, which includes data quality, because, if you're working with poor quality data, you're going to have substandard outcomes, especially if you're going to be driving actual decision making by these technologies.
I could not agree more. It's easy for algorithms to get a lot of airtime, but issues that really get my attention are get my positive attention when someone's collecting more data about something or higher quality data or more careful data, and gets my negative attention sometimes when someone's making data harder to get, less visible, or somehow corrupting it or calling it into question. Like that, at that point, like there's not really anything that you can do. I'm thinking about like government, public entities, the
Oh,
environment, things like
in
that.
Australia, we had a particularly bad thing called robo-debt, which was the government using, and it wasn't machine learning algorithm or anything, it was just Excel basically, but it was still using a formula to determine if people owed it money. And they were doing really egregious things, and some people committed suicide over being harassed by the government saying that the government owed them money. And it was really an evil program. And the fascinating thing about that was the public servants were just saying, oh, we're just impersonally executing government policy. But it was a really bad policy, but it was driven by this underlying algorithm, and you couldn't prove that you didn't have a debt for the most part. And if you had a lawyer, if you could lawyer up and just go, my lawyer will be in touch, you got off. And if you were a poor person, you would end up having your pay garnished for that government debt.
Wow, that sounds like exhibit A for like how not to use automation and data it to make the world a better place.
It is. It is. And I spoke out about it when it was running, and people were like, oh my God, you're saying it in public. And I'm like, yeah, I'm saying it in public. It's really bad. We don't want this is not good for people.
It's so bad. It like the ideal use case for machine learning is when there's a lot of decisions that are small and there's not a very high penalty for getting them wrong, but there are just so many that a human either gets bored or just can't move fast enough to do them. Or if the information is just like so broadly dispersed to be able to pull it in. Like that is the absolute sweet spot. But the whole the book Weapons of Math Destruction, Cathy O'Neill, some great case studies in there about how like similar to this, it's like when you have an algorithm, there's going to be mistakes. And when there are people, it's making important decisions about people on the other end, like those mistakes are unacceptable. Like if those decisions have to be made, you have a person make them. Otherwise, like you just
Well, you
get
need
out
to
of
be
there.
able to query it. The whole thing with the advent of generative AI, and it's been kind of a thing for a while, but it sort of popped into the public perception back in 2021, 22. And I think the interesting thing about that is ordinary people could understand what AI could do for the first time. Like people like my husband, who's a high school maths teacher, who is not technology driven at all. He uses MATLAB and stuff, but he doesn't know any programming. But he could see it and see what it could do for the first time. And I think that sort of captured people's imagination. But the problem of hallucinations is an interesting one.
I think imagination is the key word there. It's like in our household, we name our automobile, we name our devices. Like it's just a cute thing and it's fun. Like, but it's easy to personify an inanimate object, no matter how dumb it is, and to start to ascribe motivations to it and ascribe internal processes to it that simply aren't there. Now, if you like the classic Eliza computer program from, I think it was the 60s, like where it just followed some kind of rote, like you say something, it asks you a follow-up question based on that, and it sounded plausibly human. That was the original, like, blow people's minds. It's like, oh my goodness, computers are thinking. And it was in this first round of like AI, sci-fi, like it's gonna take over the world. But now, like with so much more data at its disposal, like LLMs are so much more plausible. You even people who are familiar with how they work on the inside have to be really like, we have to remind ourselves, like, there is no ghost in the machine. Like, this is like really, really good autocomplete. And yeah, if you give it enough data, it will give you very good answers and maybe even the right answers in some fraction of the cases, which it does. It's great for a lot of things, but it's not, it doesn't have this rich
We shouldn't
life.
be like those lawyers who just took the generative AI created case summary or whatever it was and sent it to the judge and had it completely invented, completely hallucinated citations.
Yeah, I mean, my wife is in the education world. She is a PhD candidate. So she gets to see students and professors working, dealing with generative models. And they're really good for cases where you have to produce words and you don't care what they are. And there are, sadly, like, that is a common use case. In even in education, and it's great for that. It can be quick. It's also really good. I've seen really good use cases where you want it to hallucinate. You're like, hey, I'm thinking about this thing. Can you give me some suggestions, some ideas, and then I will filter through them. It's great for
Well,
that.
person in the process is an important concept I think people need to get. I was just going to ask you though, do you think that RAG models, so retrieval augmented generated models, are going to be able to help reduce the amount of hallucinations?
I think so. And my kind of like one sentence summary of RAG models is, they're really good at taking what you say and then doing like a really quick local search and pulling in actual real texts that are related to it and using that. So it's kind of like some kind of a hybrid between an internet search and generative. But I think they're effective because they are a step closer to sticking with the raw data. And so I am still waiting to see some mechanism by which, they could say, like, well, even with what I've been able to retrieve, I'm not confident that this fact is the case, or that this, legal precedent has occurred. I'm just gonna sit back. I'm just gonna say nothing. LLMs are
I
really,
can't do
really bad
that.
at nothing.
I genuinely think that they're actually throwing into disarray what we've conceptualized as intelligence, because a lot of what we've thought of as intelligence is just glibness.
So 15 years ago, I was, because of the line of work I was in, I was attending these AGI conferences. And this is back when it was very much a fringe activity. It would like co-locate with these AI conferences, but be like in a little venue, like not even co-located with the
Room.
main event. Yeah, like 2 days before the real conference. And you kind of said you were going there and like winked and be like, you do it ironically. Even then, it was hard to pin down what we meant when we were talking about intelligence. And the thing that really drove this home for me is there was one big Q&A session where we were getting into it, and I just stopped. There's a room of like 100 people. I was like, so I feel like I'm hearing two things. Intelligence is, it operates with the same mechanisms as the human brain, or intelligence is, it does approximately what a human can do, like functional. And if you could have just one or the other, which would it be? What's core to you? And the room was split 50-50. So like, this this gathering, like we were all looking for something different. We all meant something different. We were talking about intelligence. And if there was a place where we had a hope of defining it, it was there. And we weren't even close.
Yeah, but I'm just fascinated because, generative AI is capable of stringing together really good words that sound really good. And I think a lot of us have mistaken that for intelligence for a very long time. And we probably need to dig a bit deeper because we now know that generative AI is often quite wrong.
Yeah. I mean, there are the jokes about, there are humans who are very good at stringing together words that sound great, and then when you pull them apart, mean nothing, or contradict themselves, or have no grounding in reality. In which case, LLMs are extremely human.
Yeah,
Whether
they are very
they're
human.
intelligent.
But
Whether they're intelligent is a separate question.
I think that's the big question for our time. What do we really mean by intelligence? And when we're probably going to be, like you said, 50-50 split on what it is
Yeah.
and any room that we walk into.
This is something that has been in my mind for a while, because even going back, so set aside reasoning, production of words, playing chess, things like that. Even if you go down to something very mechanical, like moving an arm. So back when I was doing human movement, stroke rehabilitation, there were some very large, ambiguous, unresolved questions about how the human brain even moves our limbs. And it's just so, I mean, it's just so hard to measure what's going on. We don't even know what to look for. There was even a debate, like, are we looking to measure like one neuron that controls something, or somehow it's in the distributed set of neurons that are doing something, or maybe it's in how those patterns of neural activity change over time that's doing something. And there's so much going on, and it's hard to measure it accurately. Like, no one could agree even on what we were even looking for. And this is something where we can measure movement very, very accurately. We can all see it and agree on it. There's no disagreement there, no confusion there. And we still don't know what motor control is at its core. And so abstract that out a little bit to like reasoning and empathy and model building and like, building metaphors and analogy and communicating. Building theory of mind, and it's like I love it because we are so utterly clueless. Like, it is, in my mind, the frontier. We all do it. We all see other people do it, and we don't know how.
Well, I only recently became aware of how difficult it is to build bipedal robots.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So I had friends in the MIT Leg Lab, which has done some great work with bipedal robots, going back into the 80s. But back then it was fun because I was fascinated with robots and they're doing this great research, but even then it was like their failure, their B-roll failure reel was hilarious because these robots would just like fall over or jump and land on their head or do a flip but not quite clear it or just stumble over a cord. And it's easy to forget that now because that line of research has since evolved into Boston Dynamics, and we have, the big dog, and we have Atlas, and some robots that do some just amazing things. But that's decades of focused research from some very dedicated people, which I have immense respect for. And even then, my understanding of the current state of the art is you change that hardware a little bit, and the policy that they have is not very helpful anymore. It's like it's
Wow.
very specific.
Yeah. So things that humans do without even thinking about it are really, really hard to program. Like we're really complicated.
It's kind of funny too, because we stack the deck in our favor when, chess, for instance, for a human, that's hard. Like, you have to study and practice for a long time. That's a great problem for a computer. Like, there's a small finite set of moves and rules and finite
A
possibilities
very
to.
heavily rules-based world.
So when we initially set up checkers and chess as measures of machine intelligence, like, we were really stacking the deck in their favor. But things that a 5-year-old does, like stumbles around on a shag carpet with sticky-soled shoes, like, oh my gosh, that's a nightmare for a robot being controlled by a computer.
Hey, one thing I did want to talk to you about is this idea of where you think generative AI is going. Because you've heard people talk about agentic AI, which is this idea of the next generation of generative AI with agents that can daisy chain their own prompts. And so I've been talking at conferences about how I think things like AI, Internet of Things, robotic process automation are all joining together to make autonomous systems, which now people seem to be calling agentic AI. And I sort of see that as the next interesting thing that people are going to do things with.
I like that line of research. I think that has a lot of possibility. Let's see. A couple of thoughts. So LLMs are not perfect, but they are a tool that we have not had before. So, like any tool, there's some things that they are very good at and some use cases that they just really nail. But like any tool, if you use it places where you shouldn't, it's going to look silly. So we're kind of exploring where that boundary is right now. But to your comment before about, a lot of the times are just stringing words together in a way that makes sense given the context. And so for a lot of non-critical situations, like if there's a computer program that can do that, like that can meet certain needs. Like if you're going to an information desk and asking for help, like how great to be able to do that in natural language and get a reasonable answer. So I think we'll get better at helping LLMs like not say dumb stuff. I really think that being able to train an LLM on the data that's specific to what we want it to do, as opposed to having like giant
General purpose
LLM.
LLM. So we think that we move away from general purpose to specific purpose ones.
And it may not even have so much to do as the difference in architecture as just the training data. But yeah, like domain specific, and if we can get it better at being confident in what it produces and not producing
So
things that it's not.
a smaller training data set with a more constrained set of questions that it can answer confidently.
Then we could treat it like any other human, where it's like, I meet someone new and I interact with them and I'm building my own assessment of whether to trust what they say, whether they know what they're talking about. And I think there's some really great opportunities there. I see some really good use cases there. It's also really fun, like on the data side, like right now, the easiest thing is to train on words, characters from the internet. That looks, different depending on like if you limit yourself to one language versus considering lots of different languages versus considering like very localized slang and including emojis and kind of like making it broader, but it's still just like a sequence of symbols to a sequence of symbols. They're including like steps to expand that to audio. Some great demos on the most recent GPT. I have to give a nod to like great job doing audio to audio and text to speech and speech to text. And then there is the promise of doing this with video too. The trick being that with printed text, it's already symbolic. It's already reduced to ASCII or Unicode. And with speech and video, there's this extra step of how do you take this high dimensional analog continuously variable input and reduce it to symbols and then get it in there. So I expect
I
that's
was
easy.
talking with a startup that's trying to do some stuff in that space at the moment, and they're just trying to automatically translate it to from video spoken from language to language. And that's already a pretty hard problem at the moment.
It's super hard, which coming back to robots, it's fun. Like a lot of early robot work was done in simulation where you could chunk the world. You could make the world symbolic and make it so therefore straightforward, more like a chess game. When you're dealing with physical robots, you're dealing with actual continuous, there is audio, there is video, there is these weird continually varying sensors. And you have to figure out how to get them into this symbolic state, how to make them symbols so that then you can get them into the computer's native language, like the computer's playing field. But that's to me like those data issues, data quality, data transformation, those are hard problems. That's not something that a company is going to, plow through to get the next feature out. Those are things that'll take like a year, years to kind of sort through and trial and error before we really make much headway there.
Which kind of goes back to something that I keep saying I used to keep saying at work, is that data engineers aren't going anywhere in the near future. Like, we're still going to need all the data engineers to do all the data munging to make the AI work.
The form of that that I hear a lot is like, well, we have, Copilot, we have coding assistants, coders are going to be out of a job soon. And what another person that I follow on Mastodon, Jason Gorman, he's like, typing is the easiest part. Like actually
Or
deciding
programming.
what, writing the code, like that's the easy
Well,
part.
understanding the underlying data. Like, if you've got a data set that you don't understand, you can't do anything with it. You need to actually understand that data, understand what drives what behaviors. Like, you need a human being in the loop for that too. So it's a real challenge for organizations. Like, I told my developers that if they were thinking that they would be building Power BI dashboards in the future, they needed to get that out of their head, that people would be able to build those using Copilot. That'll be so. If you're seeing your value in that, you need to get that out of your head. The real stuff is the value add of understanding the data, getting the data over into our world, transforming it and translating it so it's ready to use for AI. That's the real value add, and that's where we want to play going forward.
The domain expert, the person who has a gut feel that measuring this and discretizing it a certain way and combining it with this other thing, like the teachers who knew the five things that they were already kind of watching for, like that value is we don't have any kind of a computer that can do that. Humans are where that comes from. And that's what takes any problem and changes it from intractable to all of a sudden just a challenge. So
And that was a fascinating thing. So, we had some expertise from outside helping us with that proof of concept. We had my team learning on the job, and then we had the people in the education space working with us, and then we had the teachers' input. So it was really a collaborative thing. So one of the things that, I'm really seeing will drive a lot of this in the future is people working together collaboratively, bringing different bits to the table.
The projects that I've worked on that I've enjoyed the most have had these in the same room. You have the data engineers and you have the algorithm person and you have the person who has spent a lot of time with users and has a gut sense of kind of like what they value. And speaking different languages, valuing different things, coming from backgrounds where there's totally different incentive systems, but taking the time to build the bridges to understand, like, okay, here's where the real sticky points are and what we're trying to do. Here's the hard parts. Here's what, and here's what it'll take to make it good. Let's kind of do this. And it's confusing and it's messy and it doesn't look like a homework problem that you get a thrill out of, like just nailing the right answer. But when you're done, you feel like you have made something, like you've created something real. And that feeling is like, that's one of my favorite feelings.
Yeah, I love that too. That's one of the things that is really exciting me about being able to build things. I'm still a techno-utopian at heart, even though I've been crushed many times. So I still hold out hope that AI can make the world a better place.
I am fully confident that AI can make the world a better place. It all depends on the hands that's holding it.
And that seems like a good place to draw this lovely conversation to a close. Thanks, Brandon. Really enjoyed our chat.
You so much for having me on, Kate. It has been an absolute delight.